said you can kill my body, but you know you can't mess with my mind.
Welcome to Economics and Beyond. I'm Rob Johnson, president of the Institute for New Economic Thinking.
Say you can kill my body.
Say you can kill my body.
But you know you can't mess with my mind.
Say no, you can't kill my mind.
You know we'll go away.
We're gonna go away.
Come back, come back, come back,
come back.
My second time.
I'm here today with Gene McCaraher. He's a professor of humanities and history at Villanova University. He's written for Commonweal, Baffler, Hedgehog Review, and he's written two books, the first of which was Christian Critics, Cornell Press put out in 2000, and the most recent book from November of 2019, The Enchantments of Mammon. I would say in all of the work I do in podcasting and preparation and so forth, if I had to say which book has moved me the most that I've read since the onset of the pandemic, Enchantments of Mammon would be in the absolute first place. Gene, thanks for joining me today. I really look forward to exploring with you.
Thank you for inviting me on.
Well, in the early portions of your book, it's called The Prologue, you said, I've written The Enchantments of Mammon out of the conviction that rather than bewail or curse the twilight of American economic and geopolitical imperium, we should welcome the demise of our misenchanted way of life as an opportunity for repentance and renewal. But redemption can only come if we tell a different story about our country and its unexceptional sins. Gene, I'm very moved because of the word misenchanted way of life, not unenchanted. And I'm very interested to hear both your diagnosis of what those sins look like, what role the enchantment of Mammon has played in leading us off course, and what we can do about it over the course of this conversation. But for right now, tell me a little bit about where you became inspired to take on this project. I understood from our previous conversation that it's been almost a little over two decades in the making.
Yes, I started thinking and working on this, thinking about and working on this book in the late 1990s as I was finishing up my first book. And while I was finishing that book, and that first book I wrote, Christian Critics, was a study of liberal Protestant and Roman Catholic social thought and cultural criticism in the United States in the 20th century. And after I finished that book, I started thinking about how one could make the move from thinking about religion and theology as a historical subject to actually using theology as a tool of historical scholarship. What sort of insights could theology afford? That was one set of issues. All right? There was a lot of discussion in the 90s among historians who were religious, especially people like George Marsden, who I think is now retired from Notre Dame. And he was writing about, the outrageous idea of Christian scholarship and saying that religious historians should have a seat at the table, right, with their secular colleagues. And it occurred to me that, well, okay, if religious historians do get a seat at that table, it would be a nice thing if they had something interesting to say when they got there. And more, I think, than simply we have to talk about the spiritual element or the spiritual dimension in history. I mean, this always seemed a little lame to me until you could actually flesh it out. And so that was one set of issues. I wanted to think about not so much, what is the hand of God in history, which is usually the way this sort of thing gets conceptualized. What is the hand of providence in history? I'm that's way above my pay grade, I think, what the hand of God is in history. But it seemed to me that you could ask questions about what human beings are doing in history. And therefore, if you understand human beings a certain way, as people who long for communion with divinity, that might be able to give you some kind of insight into historical action. So that was one dimension of what was drawing me to this subject. The other, of course, was the way in which the world was developing after the collapse of the various communist regimes in 1989, when it seemed as though, as you know, Margaret Thatcher rather infamously put it, there is no alternative to capitalism. It seemed as though capitalism had genuinely triumphed and that there were no other contenders on the historical terrain. And one of the things that began to strike me in the 90s was the eschatological character and import of a lot of the, you know, what we would now call neoliberal discourse about the triumph of capitalism. You know, you had guys like Francis Fukuyama writing about the end of history. You know, Fukuyama was basically trying to argue that, you know, the consummation of all human endeavor was now, you know, a global factory come shopping mall, even though Fukuyama himself, I think, was more ambivalent about that development than his phrase led on. Still, the end of history has this kind of end times aura about it. You had people like President Bill Clinton talking to a meeting of the World Trade Organization in, I think it was 1998 or 1999, talking about the triumph of markets as, you know, the fullness of history. You know, these are eschatological terms. And I also started to see this religious character in advertising. You know, I can think of a couple of ads that I recall seeing in the late 90s. One was a Microsoft ad in which an older black woman was sitting on a bench and her arms are being held up and outward to make her look, I think, somewhat like Shiva, the Hindu goddess. And these little children were, you know, running around her while she was sitting on the bench. And I was wondering, you know, what the hell is this? I mean, you know, this is a Microsoft ad. I was also thinking about this one Infinity ad, again, I think from the late 1990s, in which you never see an actual car. What you see is this cloudy, gloomy background, and then you see a bird flying across very slowly, and then you hear a voice which simply says, "Infinity." And so I started thinking about all this, and I began to wonder, you know, is capitalism taking on some kind of religious dimension now? Is it taking on some kind of sacral character, which then led me to think, maybe it's always been this way. You know, has capitalism always had this kind of sacred dimension to it? Is it, or has it become a kind of surrogate for traditional religion, for traditional divinity? And so inevitably, you know, this led me to start questioning the inherited narrative, of course, has been that of Max Weber, and it's usually been entitled The Disenchantment of the World. You know, Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels have their own account of it in the Communist Manifesto, but Max Weber's phrase has been the most renowned and resonant. You know, and Weber's account is basically that, you know, with the advent of Calvinist theology and the Protestant Reformation, the old Catholic sacramental way of looking at the world began its slow demise, right? And so in the Catholic sacramental imagination, matter is capable of mediating the supernatural. Matter, in fact, has this sacral significance. It's not, we don't live in a disenchanted world. And Weber's account is that, you know, through Calvinism and through other kinds of Protestant theology, this enchanted view of the world slowly dies. And what this does is it enables the emergence of a capitalist way of looking at the world, which is allegedly rationalist, it's allegedly simply pecuniary, and this demise of the sacramental imagination allows capitalists to then accumulate capital, to develop technology, to basically exercise a monetary and technological control over the world, which is understood as simply, you know, lump matter. It's simply inanimate stuff that can be manipulated by human beings for whatever purposes there are. They have. And what I contend in the book is that this is a fundamental misunderstanding of what's going on. Through a study of economics, marketing, product design, industrial design, management theory, business journalism, and any number of other venues, I argue that what has in fact happened is not a disenchantment of the world, but a kind of re-enchantment of the world, or as you note, a misenchantment of the world, in which money basically becomes the moral and ontological arbitrator of capitalist civilization. In other words, money becomes the new form of enchantment in the modern world. And that, you know, to me is a misenchantment. It is a perversion, a predatory version of the sacramental imagination. And it leads, I think, to a great deal of iniquity. It leads, I think, to, I think in a lot of ways it leads to our current ecological calamity, which is, I think, already unfolding. I think you can see this at its worst in a lot of what's happened over the last 5 to 6 months, both with the pandemic and with the economic turbulence, you know, that we've undergone. I genuinely think that the last 5 to 6 months has been an apocalyptic moment. And I don't simply mean in the sense of end times. I mean in the original Greek sense of the term apocalypsis, which meant revelation or unveiling. You know, in addition to revealing just how dysfunctional, you know, our ruling class is, you know, in addition to showing just how inept and corrupt, and I think in some ways uninterested in ruling they've become, it has also revealed a number of things. In addition to the fact that, as Pope Francis says in his most recent encyclical, it reveals our false securities, which I think is a really, really resonant phrase. I think it's also revealed this cult of mammon. And one of the ways, perhaps one of the most callous ways in which this was exposed, was early on in the pandemic when there were calls to force essential workers, and often not just essential workers, to go back to work because we can't let the economy collapse. We can't let shareholders take any diminution in their in their profits. This was you know, people arguing that we should simply sacrifice people on the altar of mammon. It was astonishing to me that, you know, people would go on television and say that they would be willing to sacrifice themselves for the economy. And I thought that this is insane. And yet, I just thought, well, I guess everything I wrote in this book must be right, because they're willing to be sacrificial lambs on the altar of money. And this is how deeply entrenched this pecuniary cultus has become. So I think in a lot of ways the pandemic and the economic turmoil that we've undergone has only, I think, demonstrated that we really do have a misenchanted way of life. And that misenchanted way of life is going to have to undergo serious renovation, if not, you know, destruction over the next 30 to 40 years. Because it's simply unsustainable on many levels, I think, economic, ecological, social. I think that we really are at some kind of a turning point. And I think that one thing that we have to, or at least that I'm insisting on, is that part of the problem is metaphysical or ontological, the way in which we understand the nature of the world. Our understanding of the world has become so thoroughly leavened by a pecuniary sensibility, you know, what I'm calling a misenchantment of the world, that it's hard for us to think any other way, even if we consider ourselves religious. You know, there are many evangelical Protestants, I think in particular, who have basically wedded this kind of misenchantment or pecuniary misenchantment with their evangelical faith. And I mean, that's only, I think, one of the worst iterations of this. But I think that the sacramental imagination, or a revival of the sacramental imagination that I talk about in this book, as primarily represented by the capital R Romantics, is going to be absolutely essential to reconceptualizing both, I would say, the discipline of economics, but also our political approaches to how we reconstruct the economy, how we think again, and perhaps even go about the design of technology.
I am very inspired by one of the authors you cite in the book, Norman O. Brown, whose books Life Against Death and Love's Body and many others. I think there's one called Apocalypse or Metamorphosis as well. But
I think that's the best book.
And but he essentially said, according to your book, the riddle of history is not in reason, but in desire, not in labor, but in love. And it's this energy, this imaginative energy, this broader vision that I think is being, which you might, it's within us all. But when you move to this crisis, a little bit like the writings you cite in your book by Rebecca Solnit, that the disaster kind of kicks the door open to finding paradise. That's not quite exactly a quote, but in other words, this dreadful experience may have contained within it the impetus to see things in a different way, to unmask things further and facilitate a transition, that without that desire, that emotional energy, some of which is propelled by fear, we wouldn't be able to go to where we have to go.
Yeah, let me say two things about that. I mean, first about the Brown quote, which I think is a way in which Brown is trying to both summon the spirit of Augustine, and in which he's also launching a critique of the Marxist tradition of opposition to capitalism. So when he says that desire is the motive force of history, I mean, this is a very Augustinian notion that we are what we desire. Brown, of course, takes that in a very different sort of psychoanalytical, I think, / mystical direction toward the end of his career. But the second part of that, not labor, but in love, I think what Marx or what Brown is aiming at there, of course, is the Marxist understanding of human beings as primarily homo faber, as, human beings as makers. And I take that throughout my book to mean that, capitalism really is a love story, right? I mean, Michael Moore was actually right about that capitalism is a perverse love story. It's a story about errant love. Because at least in Christian theology, because we are sinners, our loves are still there. Our desires for God and for community with others are still there, but they are perverted. They are misdirected, and so what we do is we're constantly trying to create heavenly cities. We're constantly trying to create beloved communities. But the problem is that we're trying to create this beloved community on capitalist property relations. We're trying to create a universal communion which is mediated by money. And ultimately, that can't be done. You know, we tried, the Puritans tried to do it, the evangelicals have tried to do it. You know, I talk about the rise of the corporation and corporate capitalism in the late 19th century. There were all kinds of redemptive and salvific desires that were attributed to the emergence of the modern corporation. Management theory, I think, is very much about what I call the mechanization of communion. It's not simply about trying to get workers to be more productive and efficient. They're actually trying to create, I think, a beloved community of labor, but they're still trying to do it for the purpose of extracting surplus value, you know, from workers. I think where this, in a sense, though, starts to break down is in the late 20th century with the emergence of neoliberal capitalism, because I think what you see both in the, like, the first theorists of neoliberalism, people such as Friedrich Hayek and Ludwig Mises, is the abandonment of this attempt to build a beloved community on capitalist property relations. So they want to keep the capitalist property relations, but they just jettison the beloved community. And they do this, and I think a lot of neoliberal economists and neoliberal policymakers and neoliberal journalists are united in this. They represent the first full-bore attempt to cast everything, including human beings, in the image and likeness of the market. There's not even a pretense anymore to be creating a beloved community. It's all about pecuniary cosmology, pecuniary morality. Everything has to be mediated by the vicissitudes of the market. Even the depths of human personality must now be recast in the icon of the dollar. And I think, you know, to cite Rebecca Solnit again, I think that this pandemic, in small ways, perhaps fragile ways, has revealed that human beings are capable not simply of great evil, but they're also capable of enormous good. You know, I see a lot of experiments in mutual aid going on right now. I see a lot of discussion about new ways of organizing communities, organizing workplaces, which seem to borrow from, you know, traditions such as anarchism that I don't think anybody, you know, saw on the radar screen until Occupy, and you know, might now have a new kind of relevance. We now have discussions about socialism again, which I can't help but think that's a healthy thing in American politics. Now, what exactly socialism means and what exactly anarchism would mean is, of course, something you know, to which I hope this book is a contribution, because in this book, basically, what I'm doing is I'm tracing out two lines of thinking and practice in this book. One is, of course, that of misenchanted capitalism. But the other is a capital R romantic lineage of opposition, which I think stretches all the way back to the 17th century with Gerard Winstanley and the Diggers, who I think you could see as a kind of proto-romantic movement. Stretching through, of course, the 19th century, and I think all the way to the present, which has been a kind of modern heir to the medieval sacramental imagination, and which has seen the world as, you know, as permeated by what Gerard Manley Hopkins once called, you know, the dearest freshness deep down things. And even though that sounds very visionary and metaphysical, I think it has very great political implications, because, you know, I think politics is ultimately rooted in how you see the world. You know, if you do think that the world is a completely disenchanted place, then you will have a politics to match that, which will draw only on, you know, the very terrestrial forces that that you believe to exist. Whereas if you believe that there is more to the world than simply power, or maybe what I should say is that if you believe that there is more going on in the world than what one can see or buy or manipulate oneself, then I think that you will have a politics which acknowledges, as many of the Romantics did, that love can be a power and not simply an ideal. Now, this isn't to say, therefore, that you abandon, you know, a politics, completely abandon a politics conceived, you know, in the manipulation of forces and, you know, the regular sort of activity that we associate with politics. But it does mean that you believe that even that kind of politics can be suffused or leavened by another kind of power, which I think means that you conceive of your ends differently as well as your means. It means that you will treat your political enemies in a different way. I think it goes all the way down to even thinking in a different way about the way you design productive technology. Many of these Romantics were very much inspired by an artisanal or craft-like conception of labor. And they were, I think, among the most prescient and incisive critics of mechanization and what it does to human beings, how it degrades their labor, how it impoverishes their imaginations. And they always argued for some kind of a revival of this artisanal relationship to labor in which the head and the hand are both engaged. Now, you know, one criticism that could be levied at the Romantics, and it always is that basically, well, I guess they sound like a bunch of Luddites. I don't conceive of them so much as Luddites as, you know, asking the sorts of questions that, say, John Ruskin asked about mechanization, which were, what is this doing to human beings? Is the purpose of technology simply to produce more and more and more, or is it to do something to and for us? How does technology enable human flourishing? Now, I don't think that necessarily means a certain kind of technological backwardness, but it should, I think, mean that the design and deployment of technology should A, be more in the hands of workers, and B, should answer these, I think, very important questions, which people like Ruskin and William Morris and I think in many ways anarchists and arts and crafts writers have asked with I think a great deal of insight.
You've cited in your book, I remember a book that I read years ago, and I used to teach segments of it, the Union Theological Seminary, called The True and Only Heaven, by Christopher Lash, mm-hmm. and you say in it that it's not just progress versus our critics. That's a little bit like disenchanted and secular science as opposed to what you might call almost an unconscious enchantment attached to markets and science. Well, here I see a lot of people, like you say, criticize the Romantics or what have you by creating this dichotomy between progress on the one side and critics who are Luddites on the other. But you ask the question that the real concern you have is, what is the meaning of progress? And I remember Ruskin had this passage that I read, there's no wealth but life. And that the yes. distinction between wealth, which produces a full breath, bright-eyed, and happy-hearted human creatures, and ilth, which causes devastation and trouble in directions. Well, if people are viewed as the ends, the development of humans, that's a very different thing than if people are viewed as what you might call the means as input to production, and you measure progress in those disembodied monetary and technical terms.
Yeah, when it pained me a bit to write that about Christopher Lash, because I have to say, I mean, one of the reasons I'm a historian is Christopher Lash, you know, reading his books from the 70s all the way through the 90s. He was a great inspiration to me. And yet, I think that the true and only heaven is in some ways misconceived. I, as you say, I don't think it's a question of progress versus critics. That's too simplistic. And I think Ruskin offers a key to how one can reconceptualize that. Yeah, especially when he's talking, yeah, there is no wealth but life. And what Ruskin goes on further to do is to distinguish between what he calls wealth and what he calls illth, which I think is a really key distinction. So, you know, conventional economics looks at wealth as simply in quantitative terms, right? I mean, if the GDP has grown X percentage this year, then I guess we had a good year. We don't ask, well, what was produced and what was the impact of that production on the people who made it and on the people who consumed it, for that matter. Whereas what Ruskin is introducing here is a qualitative distinction between wealth and illth. You know, he defines wealth as the possession of the valuable by the valiant. And what's really key about that definition is that it takes into account both the thing or the service and the impact on the person, right? The possession of the valuable by the valiant. So there is a relationship between the thing or the service and the person in his conception of wealth. And illth is anything or service that actually is a detriment to human flourishing. And in conventional economics, wealth and illth just get thrown together in the GDP, and there's no qualitative distinction that's ever made. Ruskin insists that you have to make this kind of a distinction. And notice that this is not a distinction which leads to any kind of endorsement of asceticism at all. Ruskin, in fact, says elsewhere in Unto This Last that, you know, he wants, I think the words he uses are great quantity of consumption. I guess by way of a digression about this, one of the things that I really liked about Ruskin in that regard is that I don't think that today he would be going on about consumerism, right? I mean, one of the problems I have with a lot of anti-capitalist discourse over the last 30 or 40 years is the focus on consumerism. I think the problem with talking about consumerism is that it's a way of not talking about capitalism. It seems to me that it's a basically facile and boring kind of moralism that you get when, you know, all these writers are shaking their fingers at people, you know, yelling at them about going to shopping malls and buying too much and all that. And that's all right and good. But I think it tends to obscure the fact that consumerism is a fundamental component of the capitalist system. You need people to be buying stuff. You need people to be dissatisfied so that you can get them to buy more stuff so that you can accumulate more capital. So I think the target should be not so much consumerism as much as it should be the capitalist political economy, which, you know, requires consumerism as a structural component. So in other words, it's not just a moral issue, it's a political issue as well.
Let me ask you, yeah. You say at one point in the book, you say, I only say here that one of my broader intentions is to challenge the canons of realism, especially as defined in the, quote, science of economics. And I know the late, I'm sad to say, the late David Graeber, who tragically passed away recently, he talked about, as you point out, that there's a war on the imagination, that this accepting of definitions and therefore the structure of arguments, like what is progress, as opposed to opening it up and exploring what does progress mean. But I know both you and David had a very strong sense that a kind of neoliberal economics was coercing the exploration or the debate in ways that Ruskin would have been appalled by.
Yeah. Realism is one of those words that I always tell students to be careful about using. It's kind of like practical or efficient, right? There's sort of practicality and efficiency are sort of empty virtues, because you can, lots of things can be practical depending on the aims to which they're directed. Things can be efficient, but doesn't it depend on what you're being, in what terms are you being efficient? Why, what is your goal? What is your objective? Realism, it seems to me, is one of those words that so often gets hijacked by the powerful and the wealthy, and they simply align it with their own purposes. So it isn't real. To say that something is not realistic is simply to say that it is not supported by the wealthy and the powerful. And that's why I think that we need to, I think what we need to juxtapose against neoliberal capitalism is not idealism so much, but realism. I think that when people are criticizing neoliberal economics as being, you know, productive of a lot of the social and economic and ecological calamities of our day, they are being realistic. And I think that when they are posing alternatives to neoliberalism, we are being realistic. We are trying to transform the protocols of what is actually possible. And that's based on what is actually there, what is real. Two ways in which I think economics, the current, at least the current way that economics is conceptualized, the ways in which I think it is deeply unrealistic. One of the ways in which David Graeber thought it was unrealistic is that it told what he, I think, amply demonstrates was a false narrative about, you know, the myth of barter and how, you know, trade and money developed, and that's basically what his whole book about debt is about uncovering. What I'm was more concerned about was, you know, two of the fundamental assumptions of conventional economics are scarcity and a certain understanding of human beings. Scarcity, how did Marshall Salins once put this? It's all over by the end of chapter one, right? Scarcity, it seems to me, is an ontological assumption. I always tell students that, you know, the first day or two of economics class, you're not really in economics class, you're in philosophy class. You're being taught a certain metaphysical and ontological account of the world on which, you know, the rest of the discipline is built. And it seems to me, I would argue as a Christian, that scarcity is not the fundamental fact of the world. Abundance is the fundamental fact of the world, right? God is not a skinflint. God clearly is not interested in efficiency. The second canon of economics that I think is absolutely false is this account of human beings as utterly self-seeking, rational, utility-maximizing individuals. I don't know about you, Robert, but I've never met a rational utility utility maximizer. And I think if I ever did, I would head for the hills because I think I would be in the presence of a monster.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, it's this is simply not the way human beings are. And it's astonishing to me. I sometimes say to students, you guys in the business schools, do you realize how awful you make yourselves out to be? You know, you don't really believe this. You know, you do have friends, right? You do have families. You do have lovers. You have, you know, you've got all these human associations that are not understandable in terms of, you know, rational utility maximization. And so one of the things I hope that comes out of this book, if any economists read it, is to try to get them to think, what would an economics look like that assumed abundance and that had a much more generous and humane account of what human beings are actually like? I think we would have a very different discipline, at the very least, And I think that from that would come, obviously, very different policies and programs.
Person that I'm inspired to introduce here as I'm listening to you is the late scholar at Stanford University, Rene Girard. I remember Peter Thiel, I'd read and I did discuss with him how Girard believed in something called mimetic desire. And he had written a PhD dissertation, I believe at University of Indiana, that came out as a book called Deceit, Desire, and the Novel. And what was essentially the purpose, as I read the book, was to discern from the great novels what were the characteristics of the characters that brought, you might call, the most recognition or inspiration or satisfaction to the reader. And this notion of mimetic desire, as he called it, of finding other people, defining your goals, not in some isolation of an icy utility function, but as part of a human process that evolved and wasn't stable and could even lead to conflict. He later wrote a book called Violence and the Sacred, which was about, in many ways, there's somebody who you admire and you imitate them, but you get to a place sometimes where one or the other of you is going to prevail and it leads to a conflict. And rather than get into a fight with the individual, they create a scapegoat, a third party. That's another name of another of Girard's books, Scapegoats. And I remember I worked on a film with the documentary filmmaker Alex Gibney about Bill Buckner and the young gentleman in the Chicago Cubs fan, both of whom got demonized when the Red Sox lost in the 86 World Series. And then the Cubs fan allegedly interfered with a foul ball that was almost like a magical intervention, a negative spell. And he actually lived in something akin to a witness protection program because people were so violent. But Girard's work on scapegoating underpinned that book, and that's part of how I got into his thinking. But this idea that people are forming a demand function irrespective of other people, irrespective of how you're viewed, irrespective of what inspires you in the actions or behaviors of others, is kind of crazy. And yet it's the whole foundation of consumer theory and the notion that the market is the arbiter of what you need. I couldn't agree with you more. And I quote Graeber from your book. He said, as the legion of anthropologists, historians have repeatedly demonstrated, economics, in Graeber's forthright dismissal, has little to do with anything we observe when we examine how economic life is actually conducted.
Yes, that's true. The thing is about that, that these, I think these really wrong and really, I think, insidious views of the way the world is and the way human beings are utterly contradicted by the actual practice of, say, advertising agencies, marketers, you know, the whole business intelligentsia that's dedicated to shaping human desire. You know, I mean, they assume from the beginning that human desire is pliable, that there are certain things that human beings do in fact want, and we know how to manipulate it in order to attach it to commodities. You know, this was, I think, the evil genius of one of the greatest market researchers of the post-war era, Ernst Dichter, who, you know, had trained in psychoanalysis. And when he came to New York, I think it was in the 1940s, He basically said, look, I know how to connect the deepest human desires to soap, right? I know how to connect the most profound human longings to cigarettes. And he wrote this classic piece of what I think is advertising philosophy called The Strategy of Desire, in which he as much as says that we are capable, and we're going to create a civilization in which we will be able to commodify and marketize the most, the deepest human longings for love, for community, even for God. And we are going to be able to thoroughly monetize this. It's one of the most iniquitous books on one level, I think, that's ever been written in the history of marketing. Because Dichter knows what he's doing.
I'll have to pick up that and, how do I say, read some of that evil. Ideas of the Romantics you come back to, and I want to remind our listeners that Jeffrey Speer and Lynn Paramore were guests, and Jeffrey, who was at NYU, wrote a book called Dreams of an English Eden, Ruskin and his Tradition in Social Criticism. And these notions of the Romantics, like you say in your book, redefined rather than rejected realism and progress, drawing on the customs you referred to earlier of artists, artisans, peasants, craftsmanship, mutual aid, the concept of property that harkened back to the notion of the commons. And this notion, the common good, seems to be a phrase that's rising in the conversation again. Do you sense that a, what you might call, Ruskin-like revival is on the, how do I say, on the horizon?
I don't know if it's on the horizon, but I certainly think there's an opportunity to certainly reintroduce and revitalize these kind of Ruskinian or Romantic ideas about what constitutes progress. Partly because I think, you know, as I've said, the dysfunction and the evil of the present system, I think, is now so glaringly obvious that many people, I think, are longing for some kind of an alternative. One of the things I've noticed about neoliberals lately is that they don't even bother trying to argue that this system is good for anybody. I think they've actually given up on that, because it's it's clear to anyone who can see that this system is not set up for the flourishing of anyone, but, you know, not even the 1%, but the, you know, 1% of the 1%. I also think that even though there's certainly been a revival of interest, especially among 20, 30 somethings, in socialism and even in Marxism, I think any sort of acquaintance with the historical record, you know, demonstrates that at least traditional forms of Marxism have, my God, eventuated in slaughter and oppression and, you know, totalitarianism. And I just don't see how, Marxism in some sense as a coherent, cogent system really can give us the answers that we need. And one of the reasons I also think that is not simply because of the historical record, but because of the fact that Marx shared, I think, so much in common with his capitalist antagonists. You know, he shared a disenchanted view of the world. He shared, or he actually, remember, saw capitalism as a progressive force. You know, it's not, Marx is actually one of the most unlikely celebrants of capitalism in history. He sees proletarianization as a step forward. He sees the degradation of labor as a step forward. he sees technological and commodity fetishism as ironically steps forward. And I think the problem with Marxism fundamentally is that if you take Marx himself seriously on all of these questions, it's not clear to me how any kind of revolutionary consciousness could ever develop. If the hegemony of capitalism is that complete, if the degradation of labor is that complete, if the mechanization of work and technology is that complete, it's just not clear to me why anyone would revolt. It would seem to me that everyone would be demoralized by that point. So it's almost as though Marx, to me, is a great diagnostician in many ways, but not a very good prognosticator of what was to come. So I think that because, in my view, Marxist accounts of capitalism have their limitations, and the Marxist practice of socialism has in many ways been historically invalidated, then it seems to me that people who want to build a post-capitalist world have to start looking elsewhere for their inspiration. And, you know, to me, this romantic tradition, which is not disenchanted, which sees great value in artisanal conception of labor, and which has always had a much keener sense of the ecological limits within which we have to live, I think is a great treasure trove of political imagination for our time. You know, one other thing, if I can just talk about this, because this has been on my mind a lot lately, because I'm writing a short book about it, is a lot of the hooey that I'm hearing about automation these days, right? Even on the left. And one of the things that troubles me about a great deal of left-wing celebration of automation is I think it's a confession of political failure. When you get writers like, say, those associated with what's sometimes called the millennial socialism of Jacobin, you have a lot of writers like Peter Fraze, and there's a British writer, Aaron Bastani, who has written this, I think, utterly loony book called Fully Automated Luxury Communism, in which he goes on, you know, for pages about how wonderful Elon Musk is. I think that what's going on here is that this is a confession that the working class didn't turn out to be the revolutionary agent that, you know, Marxists thought they would be. And so what we're going to do is we're going to outsource our political imagination to Silicon Valley. And instead of, you know, the proletariat as being the revolutionary vanguard or agent now, it's going to be the tech bros at Silicon Valley. And what we're going to do is we're going to take over that technology and we're going to somehow use it for our own purposes. And what this misses is the fact that, isn't it true? And this has been noted by any number of romantic critics of industrial technology, from John Ruskin all the way down to, you know, Lewis Mumford, and I would argue even the anarchist Murray Bookchin, is that that automated technology is always going to bear the stamp of capitalism upon it, which means that you can't simply take a technology which is designed for the purposes of controlling labor and dehumanizing labor and simply believe that you're going to use it for these more humane purposes. What they would all argue is that you need a new kind of technology, which is stamped with a different kind of sensibility and a different, therefore, a different way of understanding what the world is about. So that's my sort of short rant about a lot of automation. It's not that I'm opposed to automation, you know, as a whole. I certainly think that if there are certain kinds of dangerous or tedious labor that you could, you know, hand off to robots, fine. You know, if you want to do that. But it seems to me that we should start or restart thinking about work not simply as an unpleasant task that we have to perform, which is really when you think about it again, I mean, this is another point of agreement between capitalist economics and Marxist economics. Labor is something to be avoided and minimized. To thinking about labor as a way in which we not only develop our talents, another way in which we foster communion with others, but it's also a way in which we co-create with God. You know, we really are God-like when we work. You know, and again, I don't want to in a sense reinforce the work ethic, but maybe we need a new ethic of work, you know, which puts it in its proper place, as being more than simply productive.
You, towards the end of your book, right in the last two or three pages, I think, you talk about it with the kind of disintegration of the American empire and the disassembly of it will require what you call the accolades of a sacramental consciousness to imbue our politics with a hopeful and even joyful spirit. You go on and talk about Michael Hart and Antonio Negri hinting at the notion of a new model of St. Francis, different, but how do you say, resonating with that perspective. And Francis, you say, had discovered the ontological power of a new society of love, simplicity, and innocence. And you talk about how Charles Taylor, who I've had the good fortune of meeting once, talks about breaking beyond the limits of the regnant versions of the imminent order, and how a new radicalism must come from a faith that you say is fundamentally the joy of being. It seems, I love this phrase, you're living in the new world, which is in your heart, in your imagination, amidst the wreckage of the old.
I guess I sort of stole and remade that phrase from the Wobblies, from the IWW, who would often talk about you, say that you had to build the new world in the shell of the old. Yeah, I think that's what we're called upon to do, certainly in a new way. Certainly in a way that would depart in some way significantly from the, you know, the older Marxist model of revolution. And I do see signs of this. I do see even certain political manifestations of this to which we should lend our support. You know, and the one person who comes up here is perhaps oddly to many of your listeners, Marianne Williamson. I actually found Marianne Williamson to be the second most interesting Democratic candidate in the primary, after Bernie Sanders. And even though, you know, a lot of people I know laughed at Marianne Williamson, thought she was, you know, this kind of loopy new age guru, I actually thought that she said a lot of stuff that made sense, and not simply about the toxicity of racism. But when she's interviewed, and when she gives talks on political issues, I think she makes some, you know, pretty penetrating points about the fact that people are in fact open to this kind of talk about suffusing politics, not simply with better policies, but with a new kind of sensibility about what we think we're doing in politics. You know, are we simply redistributing material goods? Are we simply redistributing power as much as we need to do both of those things? Or do we have some kind of a vision of how human relationships could be transformed, both in and through, but also apart from, you know, the considerations of power and material interests? You know, I mean, obviously, all of these things are united in some way. But to say that you want to build a beloved community, which I think is really what she's talking about, I think she's trying to revive, you know, the sort of 1960s civil rights movement, you know, student nonviolent coordinating committee notion of beloved community. And I have to say also that beloved community has been a phrase that was used by, you know, capital P progressives from the early 20th century, like Randolph Bourne. So I think this language does have a history on the left that needs to be recognized and reaffirmed. So I would, as much as I think, you know, people coming up on the left should read, of course, Marx and Graeber and, you know, Peter Kropotkin and others, I think they should read, maybe they should start reading Marianne Williamson. You know, they should also read Mumford and Ruskin and Dorothy Day and Vita Scudder and the whole sort of Cecil B. DeMille cast of characters that I have in the book.
Well, I think I remember at one passage, you quote Herman Miller, who says, in essence, we don't have to do this to build a paradise. Paradise is there. It's just kind of how we at. We conform to it or adjust to it. And as your book is coming down to the last paragraphs, you say, we can re-enter paradise, even if only incompletely, for it's always been around us, eagerly awaiting our coming to our senses, ready to embrace and nourish when we renounce our unbelief in the goodness of things. We can do this in the midst of imperial decay and in the face of seemingly impossible odds. Knowing the world has been and will always be charged with the grandeur of God, we can practice in the twilight of senescent empire, love's radiant, unarmed, and penniless dominion. Well, I want to say to you that kind of what you might call an injection of enthusiasm and of possibility is in very short supply. And I found it rather ironic as you and I were talking. And I was thinking, because I've just recently read Pope Francis' newest encyclical, Fratelli Tutti, about essentially fraternity and social friendship and very much changing the world. But as I was thinking about that, because my daughter had once written a poem that the Pope has read to many young people, she sent me a poem as you and I were talking. And it's, to me, almost part of that magical sense that came forward, because like I said at the outset, I think your book is the most challenging, inspiring, and illuminating thing that I have read in this year and had a lot of time to read since the pandemic. And the name of her poem is A Book. It goes like this. A book is paper, but a book is also a hard cover that conceals its secrets. A book is more than physical. A book is a story. A book is feeling, sympathy for the characters. A book is unforgettable. A book is special. A book describes you. A book is paper. So I see my 11-year-old child talking about that material physical thing of a book being paper. But she goes inside, and inside is all of these feelings and all of this magic and all of this power. And inside your book, which is not just a commodity, is the embodiment of the kind of spirit that I hope, how would I say, permeates the mind and the heart of all of our listeners. Gene, I want to thank you for writing the book and for sharing your time with me today.
Well, you're welcome. And thank you again for having me on. It's been a great delight.
Well, we'll have to continue to follow your writings and perhaps convene with some other people. I know Catherine Lofton is someone who I've recently been on a panel with, and there are many other authors. Maybe we'll create a webinar in honor of David Graeber.
Sounds good.
And when we'll all get together and continue to explore in these pathways where you are a pioneer. Thanks very much. We'll see you again soon.
Okay. Take care.
You too. Bye-bye. And check out more from the Institute for New Economic Thinking at ineteconomics.org.
And I'll tell it and speak it and think it and breathe it. And reflect from the mountains so all souls can see it. And I'll stand on the ocean until I start sinking. But I'll know my song well before I start singing.